The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
Well, now it's time for our Friday forum. This week, as you know, saw the Dáil finally return after the issue of the opposition speaking time had dominated the very beginning of the 34th Dáil. But as Leinster has opened its doors to TDs, the war in Gaza became front and centre of the political agenda because President Trump was aspiring to have a US-owned Gaza that would be the Riviera of the Middle East. And then, of course, we are told by the Israelis that because of our stance on Palestine, we should be among those countries that would rehome Palestinians who would be ejected from Gaza. Domestically, the issue of the super junior ministers is not going away, as People Before Profit TD Paul Murphy is now the second TD to seek legal action on this issue. Well, joining us now to talk about all of this in our Friday forum is Hildegard Nocton, a Minister of State for Disability, and Fine Gael TD for Galway West, Pádraig McLoughlin, Sinn Féin TD for Donegal, and also Sinn Féin Chief Whip, and Harry McGee, political correspondent with the Irish Times. Good morning and welcome, one and all. First of all, let's go to you, Hildegard, on the question of the US owning Gaza.
Yeah, I think first of all, it's important that from an Irish perspective in relation to this, that we don't inflame anything. We're very clear from an Irish context around respecting international law, the two-state solution. We've been very clear on that. And I think it's really important that we continue to build relations with the US and make sure that we're leading the way as we have at a European and international level around the two-state
solution.
Okay,
but we're involved in international criminal court actions. So are we likely to be targeted by Trump on foot of that?
I think
so. We can't hide. You know, keeping your head down, trying to cozy up to them may not work.
We're not keeping our head down. I think Ireland has a really strong track record internationally at a European level. And even if you talk to the Palestinian ambassador, we've played a leading role in relation to this. We have a very strong international reputation as part of the United Nations in relation to peacekeeping, in relation to the Israel and Palestine. We support the two-state solution, and that's the position we will continue to be in. But we also have a strong relationship with the US. Our diplomats are working and will continue to work very closely through our business people as well, based in the US in relation to this new administration now in the US. And we need to make sure that we're protecting our own economy.
So are you saying that the government's stance is that no matter how crazy Trump behaves and what he aspired to in Gaza, to build a Riviera-type resort in a land that is the homeland of Palestinians, I mean, that's on the face of it crazy, that the policy is keep your head down.
No, that's exactly not what I'm saying. And we have a track record supporting the two-state solution. We've been very clear, very vocal in relation to that. But we also have a really strong track record, Ireland, abroad and here with our diplomatic corps, of building relationships and being the peacekeepers at an international level. And that's the space we're in. So I think we all need to keep cool heads here, work with the administration, the US administration, and also with our EU partners in relation to supporting the people of Gaza. And even just yesterday, the Taoiseach, the Simon Harris, announced an additional €20 million for UNRWA, who are going in to support the people of Gaza.
Yeah, while saying that there's an effrontery involved on the part of the Israelis, saying that anyone who supported the Palestinian state would therefore be the appropriate homes for Palestinian refugees.
And I think that's, alarmist and inappropriate, I think, language. And again, we need to continue doing what we're doing at an Irish level, at an EU level and international level, supporting that two-state solution, that process, but also using our diplomatic corps, our business people who are based in the US, but also our EU counterparts, working with them at an EU level.
Pádraig, I've just watched Hildegard there construct a high wire upon which the government is going to have to perch for the next 4 years.
I think the difficulty right now is rarely in human history have we had such a powerful political leader with such a limited knowledge of global affairs, indeed ignorance of global affairs. I mean, we had statements from Donald Trump about, taking over Greenland, the Panama Canal, renaming the Gulf of Mexico. So it's hard to know what to make of what he said, but I'll say this much. It was utterly reckless. So you have hundreds of thousands of refugees. And as you know, Pat, out of that 2.1 million population, about 70% are refugees. It's a refugee population. And they're returning to utterly destroyed communities. no hospitals, schools, homes. And that's the problem. It's utterly reckless what he said. Whether it will ever see the light of day, I doubt it. But it's utterly reckless. And, you know, there's no sense of, diplomacy, no sense of international law. What he said is a stream of consciousness. It doesn't matter what the consequences. That's the problem.
Harry, how do you parse all of this? Because the man is clearly an ignoramus, a cunning ignoramus, and someone who has managed to make himself wealthy. We think he's certainly going to make himself wealthy over the next 4 years. But what do you do with someone like that?
His approach tends to be visceral, and he shoots from the hip, and sometimes, unbeknownst to all of us, he can sometimes hit the bullseye. His instincts can sometimes be correct. But, I mean, he's a buffoon. You hear him talking about Gaza, saying nobody knows as much about Gaza as I do, which is like, that does violence to the English language, even trying to think of the concept and the hell that the people of Gaza have been through for the past
year. He said, I don't have to go there. I've seen the pictures.
He has, and it is a demolition site at the moment, and rebuilding Gaza is going to be a huge difficulty.
But the notion that what he has said is that when the hostilities finish, that Israel will hand over Gaza to the Americans. It's not Israel's to hand over.
No, but Israel effectively control it.
But it's not their territory. It's not their sovereign territory.
No, but they can essentially, they do want to annex it. I mean, those right-wing members of Benjamin Netanyahu's government do want to annex it. With Trump, it's very hard to... I mean, look, he started saber-rattling against Mexico and against Canada, and he threatened them with 25% tariffs on all imports from both countries unless they tackled immigrants and also...
Now, it's characterised on the right wing in America that Trump had a famous victory over Canada and Mexico. But in fact, what happened was he saw what was leaving the shelves in Canada, booing of the national anthem, alienating people even within his own party by his treatment of Canada, who has always been a good neighbour.
Absolutely, yeah. Very loyal neighbour to
And Trudeau made the point, you know, from the trenches of World War One to the trenches of Kandahar.
Yeah.
Canada has been there for the United States, and then this guy arrives in office and dumps all over them.
But the interesting thing was that the concessions that the Mexican president and Justin Trudeau, the Canadian prime minister, made were exactly the same ones that they made a year ago. And as everybody knows, Trump is very prone to flattery and to people being obsequious to him, telling him how great a guy he is. And that can persuade him as much as anything else. This is me going back to him saying that it was visceral. Now, the thing about Trump is what he says and what he does can be two different things. And let's hope it's very early in his administration.
Yeah, but he is doing what he said he'd do at this point. I mean, what he's done with
USAID, for example.
Co-President Musk, and that's what you have to say.
Yeah,
this
yeah.
guy is wielding power that should only be in the hands of a president. Instead, he's an unelected civilian, admittedly some sort of a genius. But that's
scary. This time he has put in people... The last time he put in people who were adults in the room, this time they're all loyalists and people with very, very strong views, including leading members of Project 2025. Now, Steve Bannon, one of his former aides, used to say the thing is that you flood the zone.
Yeah.
Essentially, you come in with all this banal stuff, this over-the-top stuff, this crazy stuff. But what you actually... And then you kind of prime people for it and they're so horrified by it that you go for a slightly less outrageous option and people will accept that as a compromise. And this might be a little bit of that playing out. But with Elon Musk, it's not. I mean, USAID going from having 10,000 employees to having 290 and everybody getting fired, him going in and doing the same thing with the Treasury. It's just extraordinary.
But it
reminds you of the 1930s in Europe. There's a very, very febrile atmosphere out there, and people around the world are beginning to feel it and getting scared about it. That democracy itself might be under threat by what's happening in the US.
We had a touch of that with the neocons under
George Bush. Yes.
But before that, Senator Joe McCarthy, a Republican senator, and the scare, the Reds under the bed, and the whole idea of putting the fear of God into everyone in officialdom. You know, we better not find out you're a communist or you'll be out of your job. And now they're not even saying it's something else. They're saying, okay, DEI, if you happen to be one of those groups, you're out on your ear.
Yeah.
But generally, it's just giving federal employees uncertainty. So they will all do what they're told.
Of course.
There'll be no independent thinking.
And what's helping them, of course, at the moment is that the Republicans control Congress, the House of Representatives and the Senate. So I think one of the reasons that they're acting with such haste is because they know when the midterms come in 2 years' time, they might have to cede control of one or other of the houses, and then things will start getting slower. But the difference between now and 2016 is that some of the bluster is becoming reality, especially with people like Elon Musk and others who have been put in place, you know, Mario Rubio. I mean, everyone you look at in terms of Hesketh, all of the people that he's put in place are people who are ideologues. And that can always be dangerous when you're talking about the continuation of a democracy.
And Hildegard, the question of Ireland taking in Palestinian refugees, I mean, obviously we took in massive numbers of Ukrainians, for example, and Ukraine not a member of the EU. We made special arrangements for them. Are we likely to do the same if there's a mass forced exodus from Gaza? Are we likely to do the same here?
I think we need to pull back here in relation to what was said. And I suppose, again, this is all about Ireland's position, what we can do. And we've never been found wanting in relation to homing people who are fleeing war-torn countries. But we need to work with our EU counterparts. And I think it's really important that I think we take the heat out of this. I know we are a small, open economy. We've done a lot in this space internationally. And I think working with our EU counterparts, and even the Minister for Foreign Affairs now at the EU Council meeting has called for a meeting of foreign ministers, EU foreign affairs ministers, with Marco Rubio. And I think this is the space we're in now. It's about building relationships, calming it down, and working with our EU counterparts and building those relationships with the US, building on what we already have, good relationships there. We have a fantastic diplomatic corps. And if you have ever, I suppose, gone on trade missions...
If you're dealing with people at the other end who are not diplomats, you've got a problem. If they're simply political stooges placed in those positions by Trump,
yeah,
or Marco Rubio.
Trump is, yeah. Trump is a businessman as well. He is transactional. And I think the Taoiseach, they're setting up this advisory panel based in the US, and that would be our Irish businesses. And if you've ever been on a trade mission or gone on any foreign trip and looking at our Irish diaspora abroad, when you look at the work, these are now Irish business people, so well connected, really good at, I suppose, networking, building relationships, and those business people working with our ambassadors in the US. This is going to be key. It's through communication. It's not through shouting over the airways. And I think that is where Ireland really comes to the fore. And that is the space we're in now. Absolutely. There are huge, significant economic and, you know, potential threats coming down the track to a small open economy like Ireland, also to international, you know, peace. But Ireland, I think, has a really key role to play, and that's the space we need to be in. Continue to be those leaders at an international level through our diplomatic corps, through the Irish abroad.
Yeah, I would agree, actually, with much of what Hildegard has said in terms of cool heads. America is not just the White House. You know, obviously, you have the House of Representatives, the Senate. You know, it is a very divided country. You have obviously the unions. The Irish diaspora is really powerful. Any of us who have been there have seen, you know, the impact of that and the way they network. So we do need to lean on all of that right now. We do need to protect our interests and work together on that. But here's the problem. I think that's the language, and he understands this, Trump. It's you know, this thing about the political brain. You speak to people's emotions, you know, than to, you know, being rational. So I think that when he makes statements, I mean, I know I got a lot of angry feedback from people here in Ireland, you know, who obviously have a empathy and a solidarity with the Palestinian people, not just over recent years, but going back a long way. They are deeply concerned about if this was actioned, and that's the difficulty. I mean, right now it appears to be outlandish. It appears to be incredible that you think you could just literally take over a beleaguered refugee community of 2 million. But it is causing huge distress. So I think we have to stand up for our own independence. Foreign policy analysis and stand up for international human rights and law and values, while at the same time lean on the Irish diaspora to protect us from any nonsense.
Harry, can we do this on our own? I mean, when you look at... I watched a documentary last night on Elon Musk on Channel 4, and his interference in British politics, his interference in German politics. Now, there's not much chance he will interfere here because there isn't that kind of huge right-wing movement that could take over. And he won't have time for you, Porik, and Sinn Féin and others on the left, because you're a prize anyway with Musk. But he's a dangerous man.
He certainly is, and the Roman salute, or the fascist salute that he gave at a particular rally, has almost become a meme for Elon Musk, and he seems to be indifferent
but if you
to criticisms.
That, again,
like
I watched that last night. He puts his hand on his heart, and then he throws it out as if he's kind of offering his heart to the people who are cheering him. You can interpret it
I think
a
characterizing
ways.
It as a Nazi salute is probably a little bit too much, and it just kind of suited the agenda of some people. But he is a dangerous person. He is controlling a department that doesn't exist. He's in control of a government department that officially doesn't exist. And all of the people who work with him have been given special status. They're all his kind of flying pickets. These kind of tech specialists and data specialists who've gone in to unpick the US Treasury and US aid, like people in their early 20s going in and firing.
There's at least one teenager in there as well.
Really, career criminals. And we talk about Donald Trump being ignorant. I mean, Musk is a very bright guy. He has founded some extraordinary companies, but he is also extraordinarily stupid and ignorant in terms of politics. Mm. His attack on the British government and Keir Starmer in relation to that so-called paedophile ring, there was a paedophile ring, but his allegations of a cover-up of that paedophile ring in the northeast of England was a disgrace. And his understanding of British politics is centimetre deep at the very thing. He is so shallow.
He appeared on big screen at the Alternate for Deutschland rally.
Yes.
You know, which is, it got, if not its roots, it's got connections with old-time Nazis.
And his justification for supporting them, he doesn't look at their policies. His only thing says, well, their leader is a woman who is in a gay relationship, therefore they're not Nazis. And he did that while ignoring the policies and the rallies and the terrible things that they have said. And the sad thing in Germany is that the CSU is beginning to kind of follow the AfD, the Alternative for Deutschland playbook, and beginning to impose very, very draconian laws in relation to migration. And we actually are seeing a movement to the right generally throughout Europe. We're one of the outliers in Europe in terms of our politics, which is kind of centrist and maybe a little bit right of centre, left of centre. But there is a movement towards right in Europe, and he is beginning to sow the seed of dissent in so many of those countries. And it is very dangerous. And as I said, it does remind me a little bit, and I don't want to be sound too alarmist, of the atmosphere that was in Europe in the 1930s.
OK, quick question. You don't have to answer if you don't want. How many of you are on X at the moment?
I am for my troubles, yeah.
All on X. Well, there you go. How many of you drive a Tesla? None of you.
No.
I don't either. But, you know, you've got to follow through. If you despise this man and think he's dangerous, don't support him in any shape or form.
Well, X is interesting. X has changed. I mean, the X that I read now, if I go onto the homepage of X now, it's completely different than it was 2 years ago in terms of the stuff that's been fed to me. I'm getting all this crap.
Musk has used an algorithm to amplify all his own posts, and he posts a couple of hundred times a day.
I've actually blocked him on X.
The algorithm is doing it, you know, is doing his amplification. You don't have to be on him to get his amplified
Or voices like him on your feed constantly. That's what you're getting.
All right, we'll move on to domestic politics. And the question, Hildegard Nocton, are you going to be out of a Super Junior job?
That's a matter for the courts, Pat. What I can say is that the Attorney General will be defending that case robustly. We believe it is constitutional, and I will let the legal process continue. I don't think it would be appropriate for me to comment. I am one of the super juniors sitting at Cabinet.
Exactly. Yes. So it might not be fair to ask you. I still ask you in anticipation of your reply. But Porrick, what say you? Because you've got your colleague, Pat Daly's having a go, and we now know that there's an extra voice taking it to the courts.
Yeah, and Fintan O'Toole wrote about this recently in the Irish Times. I think it's time to test this. I mean, the Constitution is clear. It's 15 seats at Cabinet, and there has been a creeping increase. We now have, I think it's four additional.
But didn't the principle apply even when we had only one, whether it was Pat Rabbit or whoever it was, the first one? Can you remember, Harry, who the first one was?
Well, there's been a chief whip since 1972. And this chief whip doesn't have a voted cabinet. Yeah. So they are essentially, they were the original of the species in terms of being a super junior.
In terms of breaking any confidentiality
rule. Yeah, so when DL went in to the Rainbow Coalition in 1994, Pat Rabbit was the first new kind of mode of super junior.
Yeah, and the AG, of course, sits in on the discussions.
And has, yeah, since the foundation of
okay,
the state.
Okay, so Porrick.
Yeah, I think what we want to do, I mean, you've seen, it has become part of the bartering of coalition governments. So obviously you had three Super Juniors last time, Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael and Greens. This time you have two independents. They weren't given a cabinet position, which is interesting because obviously the Green Party, with 12 TDs, got three seats at cabinet and they had a Super Junior. So they had four voices at cabinet, whereas this group of independents, which is nine in total, including the Hayley Rays, out of that they have nobody fixed at cabinet. So you're stretching the intention of the constitution. So Pa has taken the case. It'll come up in May.
If this is a breach of the constitution, it was then. And you say it's stretching it, but it's making the breach more, maybe more apparent. But if it's wrong now, if the courts decide that, it was always wrong.
Well, and that's true. I think that it was tolerated probably for quite a period. I know we protested in 2020 about what was emerging. And I think we're at the point now where we need to test this. I think we need to say, stop, let's get an interpretation from the courts. They interpret the constitution on behalf of the people and we can take it from there.
Okay, Harry, I mean, the rules are no more than 15 cabinet ministers.
Yeah.
Then we have the super juniors who are allowed to listen and not vote. But of course, votes are rarely taken at cabinet.
They're kind of proxy members of the cabinet and they do bring memos, but the memos are technically and formally brought through a senior minister rather than through the junior. But I mean, the constitution probably needs to be looked at because the constitution states 15 and 15 is the maximum. The constitution was written in 1937.
As 7 and as many as 15.
Yeah, but I think we probably need more than 15. If you look at the last government, Catherine Martin had a list of responsibilities that was as long as your arm, and so did Eamon Ryan. And some of the ministers in the new government have some very varied kind of departments under their control. So there is an argument that we probably need to have more senior ministers. Now, whether increasing the number of super juniors is the way to do it is a moot question.
But if the courts say these jobs should not exist, then we have to go to the people to get the people to change the constitution.
Yeah, I'm not sure how that court case is going to work out because you have the super, they don't have a vote at cabinet. And it depends
on. Confidentiality is the key, isn't it?
Yeah, but then you have senior civil servants in there, the Attorney General has been there and ad infinitum. So there will be an argument about that. And it's very hard to second guess what the courts will say in relation to, you know, what the constitution actually lays down. Is it presentalism? Is it being there? Is it confidentiality? Or is it the fact that senior cabinet members are the people who make decisions and the people who make the votes, and whether the Ruan Dangan aspect of it, is it the vote that's more important or the Ruan Dangan? And that's something that I wouldn't be in a position to even begin to try to guess what the courts are going to say.
How
in relation
quickly
to
is this likely to come to the courts?
Well, there's two hearings and they're different. Pat Eddy's is a judicial review, as far as I know, and the case that's been taken by Paul Murphy is by plenary summons, which is the usual way. But I think that he is seeking, in the meantime, he may be seeking an injunction, an interim injunction, maybe even an interlocutory injunction. So what you might have is you might have an ex-party hearing where he actually tries to block temporarily the appointment of the junior ministers until the full hearing or the interlocutory hearing kind of trashes the matter out. So
this would accelerate its way, though, wouldn't it, through the courts, because it's seen as so important?
Yes, of course it is. It's a big constitutional matter, and it's the government, and it's in relation to the running of the country. Of course it would, but both would take several months before they would wend their way through the courts. Couldn't be done in a matter of a week or 2 weeks. The arguments are too complex, and you will also have in the plenary case you will have witnesses being summoned on both sides.
My goodness. All right. Arguing about speaking time, arguing about super juniors while the world is coming down around our shoulders. This is one of the, and Storm Éowyn is just an example of events, dear boy, events.
Yeah, they're all important. But I mean, I suppose when you look at the context of what Trump is proposing to do in Gaza, you know, you kind of say it's a relatively small beer in comparison to that. But at the same time, all of these things, the small things can be important as well, just in terms of establishing principle. Storm Éowyn has been, you know, there was a catastrophic event. I mean, winds that were measured at 185 kilometres an hour in Maesthead in Carna, you know, it was always going to have an impact. And no matter how resilient our systems were, it was always going to cause damage and it was always going to leave people in hardship.
The question is, did we do well or did we do badly?
Well, we were always going to do badly, but the question is, how badly would we have done if resilience had been better and preparation had been better? And the one thing that strikes me is that this network that we've put in terms of our electricity, our communications networks, you know, the fact that they were so close to forests, so close to trees, that when the storm came, that the cables were destroyed. That to me seemed like a lack of foresight by somebody.
A lot of broadband is delivered along poles. Mm. I mean, you think they're electric wires, they're not. They're actually broadband in and fibre. Hildegard, we weren't prepared enough. We didn't case harden our systems against the prospect of storms like this.
Well, I come from Galway, so Galway was one of the hardest areas hit, the west and northwest. And I suppose the first thing to say is the priority was to keep people safe. And we unfortunately had that one poor tragic incident of that young man in Donegal who lost his life. But I think, as Harry said, it was unprecedented. But at the same time, with that said, there is a huge amount, you know, there was a huge amount of frustration and anger out there around the length of time it took some, you know, households to get reconnected. And there's still people in my own family who still don't have their power back. But what we need to do is now, for the next time, is to make sure that we are more prepared for this. I think that ESB did a fantastic job. Our emergency services did a fantastic job. Our local communities did. So what we're going to have, and we pass this a cabinet, a winter resilience plan in place within the next month, so that when this happens again, people will know where to go, where that local community centre is, that will have a generator, that will you'll be able to charge your phone, get showers, get food. Also those forestry corridors for the future, to make sure that our electric lines are not infringed by trees. We also have to look at trees on private property and how we deal with that. We will have a plan in place. I want to commend all of the emergency services.
Okay. That is a given. They did a fantastic job.
Yeah, I think you're starting to hear government voices acknowledge that they were just too slow and ill-prepared to deal with this. I heard Minister Sean Canny this morning pretty much acknowledge that. There's huge learnings here in terms of the resilience. I mean, they're certainly unprecedented in terms of wind speeds, but they're not rare. They're now regular events, these types of storms, I think once, twice, three times a year. So we need to look at all those issues in terms of, like, one of the things that infuriated me was generators. You know, that you didn't have generators at water utilities, health centres, people who were vulnerable in homes. So as public representatives, we've been at the coalface in terms of dealing with the anger of the public. We have to learn from this.
And that has got to be fed in by either local politicians, local government, because the government has got to know where the problems lie, and it's been exposed by this storm. But perhaps, you know, there are some areas that got off lightly, but could be equally vulnerable. We have to know before the next one. All right, look, that's all we've time for. My thanks to Harry McGee, to Pádraig McLoughlin and to Hildegard Nocton. Thank you all very much for joining us on the Friday Forum. Don't forget, our items from today are uploaded as podcasts, which you can listen to in the Newstalk app, powered by Go Loud. Just search for The Pat Kenny Show. My thanks to the team, editor Emma Bradley, senior producer Claire Darmody, producer Niamh Dunn, researchers Cian Burns and Sinead Keogh, the broadcast assistant Anne-Marie Kane and Cormac McDonough on sound.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.